You're listening to 95.7 FM, KDRT LP, Davis, California.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies.
And that music means it's time for the Davis Garden Show. This is Don Shore.
And this is Lois Richter on a bright, beautiful, sunny Davis day. A little foggy. No, that's smoke. Darn it.
A little hot is what it is on the day that we are preparing this show or recording the show, which is Wednesday, September 8th, when we are looking at a heat advisory here in the Davis area and all through the Sacramento Valley. And today's temperature, which you'll hear about tomorrow, is going to be 104 degrees, according to the National Weather Service. I've seen other weather apps putting it at 106, the peak of this little late season heat wave that we're having here. And then we're going to drop down rapidly for the weekend. So it's going to be a complete transition in the flower and vegetable garden in 5 days. The day of the broadcast, which is Thursday, September 9th, the high is going to be 93 degrees. It's going to be partly cloudy tonight and mostly sunny on Thursday, and a slight chance of thunderstorms on Thursday night with a low of 60 degrees. Those slight chance of thunderstorms might sound great and refreshing, but unfortunately they mostly mean dry lightning in the hills around us, so that's not so good. Sunny on Friday, 87 degrees. Friday night, 55 degrees and mostly clear. Saturday, 89 degrees. Saturday night, 55 degrees. And Sunday is going to be about 88. Monday, about 87. Tuesday, about 88, with the nights in the mid-50s. So that's the beginning of our fall planting season here for vegetables and flowers, and people are already coming in looking for the What did we call them last week? The cruciforms. The cruciforms.
Cruciferate.
Well, I think the letter was cruciforms, or what we call brassicas, or all that crowd, the broccoli, cauliflower, cabbage family. Yes, they're flooding into nurseries and garden centers and hardware stores as we speak, because it is actually time to start planting those things now in the Sacramento Valley. We, of course, will talk more about that today and in subsequent shows. Basically sunny, cooling trend right on through the 5 to 6 day forecast. Someone said, do you think this is the last of the heat? And I laughed with a hollow, mirthless laugh and said, of course not.
You never know. In Davis, you just never know.
The latest date of 100 degree plus weather has been in the second week of October here. So we really feel
that
very...
That only happened once, just once.
Well, I wish that were true. We have summer-like weather typically through the middle of October, sometime around there. And we have these spells when it's in the 80s, which are lovely. And then somewhere around there, it starts to feel a little more like fall. I have a very good friend who lives in Ann Arbor, Michigan. And she was looking at our weather forecast and said, do you ever have fall there? Do leaves turn color, chrysanthemums, things like that? And I said, yes, that happens here in November. That's when that happens. So we're not in fall yet. We're very much in summer, but it's time to think about fall. And there's actually things to get going on in your vegetable garden at the very least.
Before we get into all of that details, I have a couple of announcements. May I do those, Don?
Yes, good plan.
So we are airing this show on the 9th. It broadcasts on the 11th. On the 11th, that is Saturday, the African Violet Society is having their annual show and sale. It's in the courtyard of the Shepherd Art and Garden Center, which is on McKinley Boulevard in Sacramento. And it will be Saturday from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. So after you get done listening to our show, you can zip over to Sacramento. Yep. The other one is the following week, again, Saturday, and at the same place, is the Begonia Society and their annual show. That one, they're doing both Saturday and Sunday. So September 18th, Saturday from 10 to 4, September 19th from 10 to 3. So 10 a.m., Shepherd Garden Center, any Saturday, you're having a good time.
And if you want to look it up, it's Shepherd is S-H-E-P-A-R-D, Garden and Arts Center. Shepherd Garden and Arts Center. Almost all of the garden clubs in the Sacramento area meet there. And so that's where they have these sales. Very open area. There's places outside in nice weather they can do these kinds of things. And we're going to just assume that they have all the appropriate COVID protocols in place. Hey, Bohart Museum of Entomology at UC Davis is still doing stuff, even though you can't walk in there and look at the insects. You can get all kinds of interesting information at bohart.ucdavis. That's bohart.ucdavis.edu. Did you know that the Bohart Museum of Entomology has a gift shop?
I did not know that. What do they sell at the gift shop? Bugs?
No bugs. They have, some incredibly cool posters, honestly. I was looking at this in the Identification Manual for the Insects of California. A guide to the Ammophila wasps of North and Central America. They have charts of all the dragonflies. This beautiful poster of all the dragonflies. They have masks. You can buy Bohart Museum of Entomology dog face logo face mask. The dog face butterfly is our state butterfly. So that is their theme on their coffee mugs and their t-shirts and all that kind of stuff. So we love to feature the Bohart Museum of Entomology. And at some point they'll be back where you can walk right in there and look at the bugs. For now, they've got information and resources online and a gift shop at Bohart Museum of Entomology, B-O-H-A-R-T. That's bohart.ucdavis.edu.
You know, before we get further, I want to put on your radar, Don, a wonderful event calendar from the Sacramento Garden and Arts Center. So we can always keep up with which clubs are holding their shows on which days. And they have all the meetings listed too. So it's wonderful. I'm very excited.
There we go. And we've been looking, keeping an eye on the UC Davis Arboretum to see when the sales and stuff for the fall might be happening. There's no information there yet. We assume they're going to be having some kind of sales, just as they did in the spring. Logistically, it was a challenge, but they got it done. So if anyone from the Arboretum is listening, wants to give us an early bird peek at some of the events for the fall, send them over to davisgardenshow@gmail.com. We'll also keep an eye on the website there to let you know when their sales for the fall and winter, well, just for the fall begin. Okay, we've got a bunch of questions. Go ahead.
Normally we do something about one of our radio shows. And yeah. So today I would like to talk about my radio show, which is called That's Life and does all sorts of strange things. And I am going to be recording people who want to talk about their pets. And it's going to be cattails and animal stories. And I'm inviting anyone who wants to come to a Zoom with me on Saturday morning and tell your stories about your animals. And maybe I will be able to extract parts of those and turn them into a radio show. So if you are interested in doing that, if you know my email, send me an email. If you don't know my email, phone me. If you don't know my phone number, well, it's 530-902-0209. And I know I'm not supposed to do that on public radio, but what the heck?
Hey, I sell cattails.
That's spelled different.
Totally different blend. All right. We got a bunch of interesting questions all over the map this time. Let's see. You decide the order. Go ahead. Talk about tomatoes. All right.
So Don's been getting a lot of people concerned about tomatoes. You know, it grew, but it didn't set fruit, or it's struggling to grow, or this, that, or the other. So he wrote up this thing, some notes about this tomato season. Why don't you go through this, Don? Because it's jargon laden, and I'm going to have trouble reading it without seeing it before.
And we're just going to do parts of it. We've had a lot of, many of you are familiar with the site called Nextdoor, which is just about as useful as Facebook in terms of getting good gardening information, he says sarcastically. But someone posted.
Local, Don.
It is local. Yes, you can get local misinformation instead of international misinformation. And it spreads faster than the speed of light. I said to someone, it spreads at the speed of light. And someone said, well, technically faster. That's true. So someone posted they're having difficulty with their tomatoes. Everything in their garden had struggled. And it wasn't just tomatoes. And they went on. And there was the usual, I don't know how many comments it's up to now. Probably over 100 at this point. Some people who had great results, some people who had terrible results. And that's normal, by the way. I go through this every year, right about now, we're getting into September. And some people are coming in saying, I'm ripping out my tomatoes, they're all done. And I'm scratching my head going, I'm just like 10% of the way into my harvest at this point. But that's the way my tomatoes grow. I can boil this down to you, in spite of all the things that were thrown out there about it having been way too hot, really hot summer. It wasn't unusually hot, particularly. Lack of bees, doesn't matter with tomatoes. The pH problem of the soil, not an issue with tomatoes. Most people, when I would have a chance to talk to them in more detail, were not watering anywhere near enough. It's really that simple. Vegetable gardens are probably the highest water using square footage of your property. You're intentionally putting a lot of water into something of value. So don't let that freak you out. But I can tell you that if you stress your vegetable plants, just as if you seriously stress your fruit trees, it's going to have a significant impact on yield. In some cases, there can be quality differences that may be desired or maybe not if you cut back on watering. We can talk more about that. But if you don't water them enough as they're growing, especially in the early part of the season when they're getting going, they're simply not going to hold fruit well. If they're drought stressed, some of the first things that go are the new growth, the flowers, and the developing fruit. And when people would tell me how they were watering, I would realize that they're giving their tomato plants, typical range is 2 to 5 gallons of water per week total. A tomato plant, an indeterminate tomato plant, which is a vine, the kind that gets big, that grows 6 to 10 feet, goes up and out of the cage, all that kind of stuff, uses, by my experience and calculation, about 10 to 20 gallons of water per week. That sounds like a lot. I couldn't hear that. Sorry, what?
Per tomato plant?
Yes. Yes.
Tomato plants, you have to triple that.
10 to 20 gallons of water per week to keep it actively growing, blooming, and fruiting. An exception would be, of course, determinate tomatoes. This is where it does get a little jargon laden, but at the beginning of the season, way back when, we talked about these terms. A determinate tomato, well, they're harvesting them in the fields right now. As you drive around Yolo County, you can harvest a lot of tomatoes right now yourself by driving around Yolo and Solano counties and going to where there's a bend in the road. There's usually a pretty good pile of tomatoes lying right there because they don't tarp over the trucks. They just round the corner, they lose a few. We lost about a quarter of a truckload on one of the county roads near where I live, and people were out there with bags harvesting like crazy. Those are determinate tomato plants, which grow to a certain size, flower, set their fruit pretty much all at once, and that's what they want for the commercial, you know, paste processing tomato industry. They want to go out there, harvest all at once, rip out the plants, disc the field for the winter crop, and be done with it. And I have gardeners who do function much that way. They buy Roma or they buy other similar determinate tomatoes. They water them heavily. They cut back on the watering as the fruit is reached its size. They let it ripen. They're done. So that's a reasonable conversation to have with someone. Oh, I finished harvesting my tomatoes, my Romas, they're done. Now I want to buy some broccoli and put that in the same spot. That's reasonable. An indeterminate tomato should continue growing vigorously and flowering. It'll keep flowering and fruiting all the way into the fall, but you got to do a little bit of a count. So right now we're in the second week of September. It's about 8 weeks from fruit set to when you harvest that fruit and take it indoors and eat it. 8 weeks, okay. Lois is doing the math here.
November 8th.
Yeah, it'd be the first or second week of November. Now, I can tell you, living here, there's a really good chance that you would actually be able to pick and harvest that fruit. But I figure that really we look at fruit set all the way into August, and that fruit you can harvest into October. We can count on that. So if it doesn't get fruit, if it hasn't got fruit on it now, okay, I suggest you take it out and put in some broccoli because it's probably too late for the fruit, even if it were to set now, to develop. But we still have plenty of time for the green fruit that's on there. My question is, typically, why are their plants not continuing to grow, flower, set, and yield? And almost invariably, they're way, way under irrigating. When I say 10 to 20 gallons of water per plant, people often think, oh my God, that's a lot of water. It takes a lot of water to grow food. I mean, a figure that was floating around there when one of the magazines, Slate or Mother Jones, decided to do an expose on how much water the almond industry used was, it's a gallon per almond. Okay, here's a fact. It's 35 gallons of water for a glass of wine. Now, you may enjoy a glass of wine more than an almond, but or 35 almonds would be the equivalent. It takes a lot of water to produce food. Now, tomato growers put all that water on, commercial tomato growers, ones that are harvesting right now, put most of that water on early in the season. They're applying, based on UC publications that I look at geared to farmers, 1/3 of an inch of water a day. a third of an inch of water a day when our typical ET rate at that time is a quarter of an inch of water a day. So they're giving higher than ET. They're giving a lot of water early in the growth stage, early in the bloom stage, early in the fruit development stage. They do, in fact, cut back on watering dramatically. They stop watering as they get close to harvest. They don't want the fields to be muddy. They figure they've got their crop to where it needs to be. And you can do that if you want to have your crop of tomatoes be a crop. But if you want them to set, develop, continue flowering, continue setting and yielding all the way into the fall, as we are able to do here, you should continue deep soaking them. So people would ask me, well, how do you water your tomatoes? Well, I put a 2 gallon an hour emitter, the base of each plant when I plant them, and I rarely run my system for less than 2 hours. Okay, so they get 5 to 10 gallons of water when I irrigate. So I get good outward movement of the water and good depth of the water. I don't do this for my other vegetables because they're not as deep rooted. I do them more often. And I, in my soil, I can do this, you know, every 5 to 7 days, give them enough water to hold them for that period of time, because I'm just doing it out in the garden, out in normal silty loam. The second problem, almost invariably with the it's not enough water, is the people growing them in raised vegetable planters, where they built a box, and this is what started the whole conversation over there on Nectar. I built a box and I filled it with soil that I purchased from fill in the blank, and I think the problem was the soil that I bought. Well, that's possible, but unlikely. They sell perfectly good topsoil at all of the rock yards in this area, and it's what it is topsoil, fast-draining, sandy loam soil. If you buy their mix, they'll blend in some compost. If you ask them, they might even blend in some fertilizer. But water rushes through that. We've discussed this many times. And so you cannot put on a week's worth of water all at once, because it'll just drain right out of the root zone. So with raised planters, you will have to water every third day, every other day, even perhaps every day, depending on the nature of the soil that was put in. And again, the pictures they show me show pretty serious drought stress, sort of intervals of drought stress. Water deep, water, and then it dries out and dries out and dries out, they water again. The other problem with raised planters is inadequate nitrogen. I don't bother to fertilize my tomatoes except at the time of planting. They get some kind of organic fertilizer that goes down in the hole when I plant them. That's it for the season. We're not trying to push big, vigorous super vines that grow to 27 feet. We want a vine that grows to its full potential. And we don't want to see deficiencies, but you don't want to over-fertilize. Too much nitrogen can actually reduce fruit production. But in a raised planter, again, with soil that drains rapidly and that you're having to water frequently, those nutrients won't stick around. And so some kind of organic fertilizer at the time of planting is very useful. And then again, at intervals, at least during the early growth stage of the plant. So a lot of people like to use fish emulsion, which I think is great because it's safe. They can't really overdo it. Or they use some kind of manure they've incorporated in the soil at the time of planting, or they side dress with cottonseed meal, whatever it is. I don't really care. The point being, there's almost a certainty that by July, a vine in a raised planter is going to be showing nitrogen deficiency. So the two things I've seen the most by far, drought and lack of nitrogen. Not the other, I'm not particularly concerned about other nutrients, lack of nitrogen. It'd be a good idea at some point to get your soil tested, sure, to find out whether you need phosphorus or potassium or things like that. But typically, that's not the issue. So the biggest problem has been that the poor plants just can't get going. If your vine isn't growing vigorously in May and June, you're not going to have much of a yield in July, August, September. And what I find is people start cutting back on the watering, or they just water the same little trickle as the season goes along. Well, your vine, a tomato, if it were planted, let's take a champion variety, indeterminate variety, put it on the ground and don't stake it. Try this. I've done it. It's fun. It'll cover an area 12 feet across, right? That's the area, that's the surface area of that plant, that the foliage is transpiring and taking up water. And remember, it uses more water than your lawn. So you're going to need to give that plant a lot of water, particularly early in the season, to get a good, strong, healthy vine. There is a practice, and I've discussed this, recommended it for some people who want to do this, where you get it going, it starts to flower, the fruit starts to set, the fruit develops, it's expanded, it's getting to full size, and people then cut way back on the watering to improve the fruit quality, which it will do. You'll have fruit with more concentrated flavor. It improves the aroma, it actually changes many of the constituents that we associate with good flavor and good aroma. It does, however, reduce the likelihood of that vine continuing to flower and fruit well on into the fall. So your trade-off there is some really good tomatoes in August and a lot fewer tomatoes in September and October. If you wish to do that, fine, but be aware of the consequence of withholding water. You can water deeper and less often as the season goes along because the roots are deeper, but in a raised planter, they probably aren't. In a raised planter, you're basically growing it in a container.
So you said something about getting a soil test, but that's only if it was out in your open ground. I mean, there's no point in getting a soil test for a bagged product in a container.
Bagged product, you probably don't need to, but when you purchase topsoil from a rock yard, which is what we're usually talking about here, they've called one of the local rock yards, they're filling planters that they've built, they're getting 4 or 5 cubic yards of soil delivered, which is typically going to be a sandy loam from somewhere. Wouldn't be a bad idea to ask if they've done a soil test. Sometimes they have. You know, they may be able to provide a soil test. The first thing that came up was someone saying, oh, the pH is probably a problem. You should have it tested for pH. Well, first of all, it's probably not a problem, but sure. I mean, they might already have that test done. You can do simple soil pH tests yourself. You can do fairly simple nutrient tests yourself that are not terribly accurate, but give you a general reading. And I can tell you what they're likely to say in our area. People listening in other areas, it would be worth it at some point to have your garden soil tested. And if you're buying in and you're filling these extremely expensive raised planters you've just built, it might be worth the expense of having that tested as well, just in case there's some deficiency of phosphorus or potassium or something like that. It would be extremely unusual. I've never personally seen that on a soil test, but it would be worth knowing. The one thing you're sure to be deficient on is one thing they never test for, which is nitrogen. They don't test for that because they cannot accurately do so. Or if they do test for it, the recommendations they give are very general because they are aware that their test is going to be relatively inaccurate for nitrogen. Some source of, and I always say organic, not because I'm organic advocate specifically, but because it's slower acting, and an organic fertilizer applied at the start of the season is a classic slow-acting fertilizer, gives the plant what it needs throughout the whole growing season. Manure is a perfectly good slow-acting fertilizer, and I just suggest that if you're using a synthetic or conventional fertilizer, you'll need to do it more often. So if you happen to prefer the well-known soluble brands of fertilizer, plan on applying those once a month through the growing season, whereas with something like cottonseed meal, you could just apply that at the time of planting. So when a plant grows well but doesn't flower much, it's usually from too much nitrogen or too much shade. In a lot of cases, it's people who've been gardening in the same place year after year, and they didn't really notice that the trees have grown up behind them, next to them, to the west of them, over their yard, and the plants are only getting 4 to 6 hours of sunlight instead of 8 to 10. My tomato plants see the sun from the moment it rises till the moment it sets. There's a lot of discussion about how it was hot, so you need to shade your plants. I've never in my life shaded a tomato plant, and I can't really imagine doing so. In terms of yield, it would reduce your yield overall. It will protect the fruit that's about to ripen during a heat wave. So the one thing you can do is either go ahead and temporarily shade a plant if there's a bunch of fruit on the west side of the plant that's going to be exposed to the 106 degree temperature that day. A better bet, if it's close to color, just pick it, bring it inside, and it'll ripen just fine on the kitchen counter. And as noted before, it'll actually ripen at the regular pace on your kitchen counter, and the ripening process in the garden is slowed down by high temperatures. So going out on a day like today, as we are doing this broadcast, when it's going to be 104 to 106, you got a bunch of fruit out there. You can see it's open to the west, which is the hottest time of day here in the Sacramento Valley. Maybe pick the ones that have started to turn color or are closer to ripe because they could be damaged by the extreme heat, and they'll ripen, finish ripening just fine on your kitchen counter. We have not been unusually hot this summer in terms of pollination weather. We have not been unusually hot in terms of days over 100 degrees. We did have very early on an extreme heat episode in June where some local records were broken for that day around the Sacramento Valley, and it was really uncomfortable, 108 to 110. But overall, our average temperature, average high, July, August, June, about average, about normal, about what we typically get. There's been about 90 degrees to 92 degrees average high temperature. There were a number of spells, 5 or 6 spells of very cool weather by our summer standards, where pollination should have been occurring. So it wasn't that it was too hot. It wasn't that there's a lack of bees, because again, tomatoes don't need bees in order to pollinate. almost always, with a few exceptions, the problems that we've been seeing have been related to how people are watering, or I should probably say not watering. We have seen some nematode problems, as usual. We've seen some verticillium wilt. We've seen some fusarium wilt. We've seen some issues, even one customer who routinely has a problem with tomato russet mite, which just drives him crazy. But these are about at the normal levels that I encounter as a retailer. It's, you know, someone will come in with a picture and I'll say, okay, this looks like fusarium wilt. It's not most of the people who are having tomato problems. It's a handful of them. Those are things to become aware of, and we can talk more about them perhaps as we get closer to when you're ripping out your tomato plants in, let's say, early October or early November. But we did not have unusually different temperatures. 47% of our days in Davis were suitable for tomato pollination during the crucial period from mid-May through the 1st of September. Typically, it's about 50%. Compared to 2017, when we only had 35% of the days where it was suitable for pollination, and most people's yields that year were low. 2017 was indeed a hot summer. 2020, 6 weeks of smoke. Don't know what the direct impact of that was, but definitely had some effect on how people felt about their gardens. I suspect it mostly just kept them from going out there and noticing what was going on. But this year, it hasn't been all that unusual. And so the variability I'm seeing typically has to do with the soil they're planted in and how they're being watered.
And if you, listener, think that you had fusarium wilt or the whatever those things are, think about what plants you want to plant, what species and varieties you want to plant next year. And before the season gets started, we'll talk about what those letters are, those VF letters, and what they mean and what we need to know about as far as updates. So we'll do all that in the spring when it's time to plant your tomatoes.
Yeah, we'll tell you what to look for and all that kind of thing. One thing is, as you're pulling things out at the end of the season, I always tell you to cut things off rather than pull them out, because it helps to build the soil. If you've had a problem with a plant, pull one of them up and look at the roots. Take a picture, send it to us, davisgardenshow@gmail.com.
So we go on to some other topics that we have, and this one is actually also tomato related. And so these are our people's discussions. Sometimes they're off the internet, sometimes they're overheard, you know, in places. But anyway, this one goes something like this. My tomatoes got ruined this year by root knot nematodes.
Yep.
The lady at the ag department told me I need to add a bunch of compost to my soil. So I got black plastic over it now to kill the nematodes. She suggested I add a fair amount of organic compost. Don?
That's very interesting. I first encountered the idea of adding organic material to suppress root knot nematodes from publications by the Rodale Institute, which are best known for having published the magazine Organic Gardening for many, many years. And they had their own little research farm, they called it, where they would test things. But these were not what I would call peer-reviewed ag science type of publications. These were, here's our test, here's how we did it, here are the results. It is true that organic material in the soil encourages the development and growth of beneficial nematodes, which can suppress or even kill the development and growth of root knot nematodes and various other nematodes. Nematodes are a fascinating field of study. Little microscopic worm-like things that you can't even see that are out there by the billions doing good things and bad things in your garden. There are beneficial nematodes, there are harmful nematodes. There is some evidence that organic material helps to create a better equilibrium in your soil with respect to the presence of the harmful and the beneficial nematodes. If someone knows they have a bad case of nematodes, adding organic material is not going to cure that. I want to say that real clearly. Also, putting plastic over the soil, black plastic or clear plastic, solarizing the soil, in the long run, is also probably not going to make a substantial difference in the nematode population. I'm very skeptical about the efficacy of soil solarization. You will read about it for a variety of things. It's a process where you take actually clear plastic, usually not black plastic. You get the soil properly watered. You put this plastic over it. You seal down the edges very carefully. You'll find great information about this at the UC Davis IPM website, ipm.ucdavis.edu, which now redirects to ucanr.edu, but it'll get you there. And you wait a while, and you can put a soil thermometer in there, and it's really impressive. You can get temperatures 160, 180 degrees at the depth of where you have that soil thermometer probe, which is 4 to 6 inches down. That's not deep enough to kill out pathogens or pests like nematodes for a substantial period. It can suppress the population. So
it can kill the wheat seeds, though.
Some, yeah, but not others. Again, it's one of those things that it gets touted. It works okay. It helps. It's not a panacea. Adding organic material is not, certainly not. It's the kind of thing where if you have a soil with a good proportion of organic material, and I couldn't tell you exactly what percentage that would be, it'll help keep things healthier and you'll have good beneficial nematodes in there. I'm a little surprised that someone at what she said was the ag department suggested this. So I'm not sure. Maybe she was talking to a master gardener who was suggesting this. That's certainly possible. It's one of those things where the idea has been around for a long time. There's not a whole lot of published data that really says this works real well. It's one of the reasons we tell you to move where you plant your tomatoes each year. If you get a nematode problems accumulate, they're living on the roots, they're getting more and more of them, you don't have a problem for a while, then they reach something, some sort of a critical mass, and all of a sudden you have a year where susceptible varieties are just look like they're wilting during the day, even though you know there's adequate soil moisture, the plants aren't growing real well, they're flowering and fruiting, but the fruit isn't developing to its full size. A plant infested with nematodes will typically yield, but not very well, unlike the other things that attack it, which kill the plant, such as fusarium wilt, or gradually kill it, but still ultimately do so, like verticillium wilt. These are all the reasons you'll hear to not plant tomatoes, peppers, eggplant, or potatoes in the same bed, all of those in the same bed year after year, because these problems will increase. So you need to rotate. I say this, of course, I look at most people and say, you probably don't have room in your yard to do that. Most people don't have a big enough yard to say, I'm going to have all these here this year and here this year and here this year. But if you happen to be developing your backyard and you're planning to have vegetables, I would suggest doing three boxes. That way it's easy to remember what was where, and you can do your rotation that way, which helps a lot with nematodes and helps somewhat with verticillium wilt and doesn't really help at all with fusarium. Like Lois said earlier, we'll talk more about those things on the label, the VFN and the other things that are on the label. That's probably your best approach, along with rotation, to trying to manage root knot nematodes.
Does water stress, does drought stress make the plant more susceptible to root knot nematodes, or does it not matter?
That's a very good question. I don't know.
Oh, okay. All right, on to the next one. Now, this is one that I really wish I had been in the room to overhear. It's fascinating. You sell indoor plants, right? Mm-hmm. I have this plant at my house that I've had for years, and I need to get rid of this one and get a new one. I don't have a truck or anything. Do you have a truck or anything? How would I get rid of this plant? Do you have plants here that you can sell that might work to replace it?
Yes.
What was it and how big was it and what the heck are they talking about?
I think it was an indoor ficus and it was time. It was declining and deteriorating. And the question was, would we come out and take it away and bring her a new one? Almost any garden center is willing to do that. Yes, for a fee. We'll all be happy to deliver it for you. That was a case of trying to determine what the problem was. Now, if you're having a problem, she wanted a big plant. This is what really the point of my sending you this question. She wanted a big tree. She wanted a big plant in her house. By the way, folks, September 1 is move-in date in Davis. Yes. It is a time when we encounter a whole generation of new gardeners walking in and saying things like, I want a plant and I've never had one before. What do you recommend? Or, I'd like an indoor tree. Do you have any indoor trees? And you can tell they've never grown a plant before. So the real point of this was the things that they're looking for are some of the most difficult things to grow. Indoor trees and indoor palms are two that I just really want to steer beginning gardeners away from. I know, Lois, you have some indoor trees and some bigger plants you've had for quite a while, but that wouldn't have been your first house plant. Going out to IKEA and buying one of those giant 6-foot palms that they're selling, those don't do really well indoors. They'll probably never look as good afterwards as they do the day you buy them. They get spider mites, they get problems managing the irrigation and so on. They can be very problematic. Ficus trees are famous amongst active gardeners for their fussiness. Regular ficus, Benjamina, the weeping Chinese banyan is the common name for that one, probably the better known small-leafed ficus. That one drops leaves if you move it across the room. If you know, we like to joke, if you play the wrong kind of music, if they're just notorious for leaf drop in response to any kind of environmental stress. And Probably worst of all, and I've actually discontinued selling these, even though I could sell them every week, is the fiddle leaf fig, Ficus lyrata, which is beautiful, bold textured, big tropical looking thing, and everything goes wrong. I mean, they just are not an easy indoor plant unless you happen, and here's the reason I mentioned that it's move-in date. These are folks who don't yet know how much light they have. They don't actually know which way their windows face. They don't know whether they're going to have more light in the winter or less light in the winter. So just as a quick primer, as we say, get oriented and figure out whether your windows are on the east, south, west, or north, because those, each one of those will have different range of plants that's particularly suited. Particularly south is great because you'll have more light in the winter, not less. Look outside and look around and see what the trees are that are shading your house right now. And if you don't know whether they're evergreen or deciduous, go find out. That's what garden centers are for. Take a leaf or a sprig in and say, I'm just curious, is this going to drop its leaves in the winter or is it going to be evergreen? Because if it's on the south side of your house shading your window and it's evergreen, it's going to be like a cave in there in the winter time. Whereas if it's a great big oak tree and it's nicely shaded now, it's going to drop all those leaves and you'll have nice sunlight flooding in your window in the winter. Those are great. If I were a college student looking for a place to live, I would look for east or south windows with nothing obstructing them during the winter time. Because then I would know I would have maximum light coming in the windows, not only just to warm the house, make you feel better, cheer you up, but it'll be better for the plants. You might even be able to grow orchids, things like that. So the trees in general, I'm going to steer people away from. We have gotten very formulaic about this because we get this question every single day at this time of year. We steer them towards pothos, easy, snake plants, any of the philodendron group. But the first three in particular, golden pothos or any of its new relatives, easy ZZ, which is this big shiny leafed plant that's incredibly easy to grow, hence the common name. And of course, snake plant, Sansevieria, which can grow practically in your closet. And then we talk about, you know, how to water them and things like that. Those are just foolproof. There's lots of houseplants that are pretty close to foolproof. Unfortunately, the attraction when you're a fan of Pinterest or design magazines or things like that are these big, bold textured plants like Dracaenas and Ficus lyrata, the fiddle leaf fig, things like that. You probably, I don't want to sound patronizing, but you probably want to work your way up to those. You want to figure out whether you really have enough light for them. Find out how good you are at watering on a regular schedule. If you're not good at watering on a regular schedule, hey, snake plant will tolerate going a month without watering. And one other thing I want to mention, and this is frustrating to me as a retailer, there's a chronic problem in our industry with the Ficus lyrata, the fiddle leaf fig, and Scheffleras in particular. Those two almost always come in with a bacterial disease on the leaf. It just is rampant in our industry. And you try to look this up online or you go into a nursery and ask them about why there's brown spots on, you know, big brown areas on the leaf of your fiddle leaf fig. They're going to get into a long discussion with you about how you're watering them, whether you need to transplant them, what kind of light you have them in. But the reality is, this has happened to us at our nursery, and I know it happens at Trader Joe's and Safeway and every hardware store. They come in, they're suddenly put into a stressful situation. This bacterial disease is on the leaf, and you get large-ish brown areas developing. Remove those immediately. And if there's a point of contact with that leaf with another leaf, make sure that contact is broken somehow. Either snip them away from each other, remove enough to get better air movement in there. Put the plant in the brightest spot you have with good air circulation and hope for the best. And I know that sounds terrible, but no, we don't have a bactericide that'll take care of this problem. The industry seems unable to get rid of the problem. And home, you know, new gardeners take these plants home, they buy them at the grocery store, they take them home, and these big brown areas start developing on the leaves, and they're misdirected when they go looking for information about it. They start getting told how to water, how not to water. It's a disease. It's on the leaf. I just snip it out. When I see it come in on plants, I immediately take scissors and remove that part of the leaf if necessary, the whole leaf if appropriate. It's not something you did. The plant came with it. I guarantee if you take it back, most places don't know this. There's not great reference books out there on the diseases of tropical plants that we grow as houseplants. It just isn't a lot of information about it. So it's a bacterial disease. It does spread by contact in areas of high humidity, like most of the rest of the country. It spreads pretty rapidly. We had a brief period here in early August when it was very overcast and humid by our standards. We had one day where the humidity didn't drop below about 30%, which is really unusual for us. Immediately, two Scheffleras in our shop, bacterial disease showed up on the leaves. And I immediately removed those leaves and the problem stopped. We moved them where there was better air movement. But this is a very frustrating thing to me, that it makes a lot of you think you're doing something wrong, which you're not. It was on the plant when you got it. Simply removing it is probably the best bet. And if you're in an area where the temperatures are mild and you can put it outside in light shade and get some air movement, that, remember, light and air movement are the enemies of bacteria and fungus. However, don't put it in the sun, okay? And speaking as someone who not only personally has done that, but who I think everyone on my staff at one time or another has done that, taken the pothos or the whatever outside, watered it, left it out there, forgot it overnight. That part is not such an issue. Morning sun gets on it and the leaves burn, and that has to go back into the greenhouse to recuperate. So outside in light shade of a deciduous tree is fine, not outside in direct sun.
So I want to go back to where we started on this, and that is people walking into your store and wanting to buy a tree to have in their house.
Yeah.
My recommendation, and I know this is not what you want to hear, but my recommendation is go and buy an artificial tree. No, seriously, there are trees. Yeah. I have a ficus that is a real life tree, and I have a ficus that is a fake tree.
Which one looks better?
Well, the fake one would look better if I hosed it off, but it's kind of dusty. It's been there 20 years. But, you know, do that for the look of it, and then buy some little plants for the love of it. And if you're new to gardening and you are going to get one plant or one kind of plant, I disagree with Don. I would go for African violets. I know they've got a bad rep, but you get them all, get three of them. They're all in the same pot with the same soil. And then you get the device, the size of device that will have exactly the right amount of water you need to put on every week. And you just keep that little tiny cup right there and you are so safe.
Okay, first of all, I'll say this. If you want a tree, buy a little baby tree and let it grow into your situation, because then it'll adjust to your light status. I mean, ficus can take lower light than people think. I think you've had a weeping fig that is adapted to a pretty low light setting in your house. If you take it home from where you bought it and put it right into that low light setting, bear in mind, it just went from a bright greenhouse, a bright unshaded greenhouse, to the store that was selling it, which is probably pretty bright. Ours is, and some of the grocery stores that do a good job locally have very bright places where they have their florist department, to your home. So you've dropped its sunlight input, I shouldn't say sunlight, it's just general light input, to down to about 1/8 of what it was before. Mm-hmm. And it's gone through that process in typically 1 to 2 weeks from the time it was in the greenhouse to the time you bought it.
And what it's going to do, Don, is it's going to adjust. The analogy I use is every little leaf on there is a little factory to make, its food. And if the factory was built for using that high input of sunlight, and you suddenly you're at a low endpoint, it's going to go, I need new factories. So it drops all the old stuff, puts out new stuff, and the new stuff is adapted to the new space. So one giant leaf drop, and then you're good to go. And then it's there and it's happening.
Yeah, except most people get to that giant leaf drop and then they get all confused about their watering. And we usually hear from them about a week or two later when the leaves have dropped and the new growth isn't beginning. But it is correct that they will transition, but it's best if you transition them more gradually. Also, again, it wouldn't be my first choice. I'd rather have you start with a pothos. But if you really want a tree, buy a little one. Go ahead and get it transplanted the time you buy it. Put it in the brightest place you have. Then slowly move it to the lower light place. And as Lois is saying, the leaf quantity, size, and then for that matter, the thickness of the leaf and other factors will be changed as it moves to the newer place and new growth comes out. You do it all at once, go buy it at the store, take it home, put it in the low light corner on the backside of your room, you're kind of asking for trouble. And there are plants that will take that low light corner, going back to pothos, easy, easy, and snake plants. All right, next question.
All right. So, by the way, if someone does have an overgrown plant at their house in a great big pot, just cut it off and throw the plant away and wrangle the pot or put something new in the pot,
give it
right?
away. Yeah, give it, go to next door and say, hey, I've got a giant ficus. Anybody want to come pick it up? There's a good use for next door.
If it's dying, then you don't want to do that. No.
Yeah, the okay. one thing I would do if you're getting plants from anywhere, and I do think this is true, whether you buy them, you know, from a reputable supplier or from, you know, you get them online from someone who's giving away, inspect them when you get them. Just look closely for scale insects in particular, mealybugs. Those are the two that can show up on your plant. It's there may be a small number of them present when you get it. They can expand, explode very rapidly in population. And you kind of wonder where they came from. Just look closely. Wash it off. Wash the leaves off. Set it on the porch and water it really thoroughly with a hose. Again, partial shade. Every now and then, there's things like ants in there. You know, if this plant was living outside, ants love potting soil, and all of us have had the experience at the time we get to colder weather, we'll certainly warn you about it. Time to bring your plants in. First thing, check for ants. It can be lots of fun to watch, bring a plant in and see some aphids on the leaves and some ants in the pot. Next thing you know, you have a whole little ecosystem going in your son's old bedroom. Speaking from experience.
Don, speak from experience, it sounds like. Yeah. Okay. So here are some, All right. Yesterday we had a customer looking for tomato plants. He was ready to start his garden. Today we had a customer looking for pepper plants, ready to plant them now. And they seemed very surprised that this wasn't the time to plant peppers or tomatoes. Last week we had our usual dad with kids looking for pumpkin seeds. Yeah. Another customer looking for tomato seeds. And Don's coming, it's, come on, it's September, it's Labor Day weekend. This is harvest time, not
right. Right. It's my, you know, this happens every year, particularly the pumpkin thing every year, the dad coming in, it's a little bit of a stereotype, but it's a real one, coming in with the kid going, hey, maybe we should grow pumpkins. And they come in September or even October. So here's a good rule of thumb. Most of the things you're harvesting were planted 10 to 12 weeks ago.
That's 2.5 to 3 months ago.
Yeah. 10 to 12 weeks is typically when you start harvesting whatever you plant. So I am now about to harvest some pumpkins to bring into my shop for decorations and sale that I planted on the 1st of July, right? And that's a little, this is one that happens to ripen pretty quickly. I also planted some a little bit later in July, which I'll be harvesting. They're green still. They'll be turning color shortly. I'm aiming for them to be ready for late October. The jack-o'-lantern trade, my understanding is, those plants are typically put in about July 1 to harvest and get to market for Halloween. Good news about pumpkins, you can plant them early. They'll develop, they'll get full size, you can cut them, they just, you know, sit there. They don't spoil or anything that quickly anyway. But generally speaking, whatever you're harvesting now is planted 10 to 12 weeks ago. There are, of course, exceptions. Radishes are much faster. And there's a period we get to in the middle of December here where it's all just kind of on hold.
Hunker down time.
Yeah, you plant broccoli and nurseries are now bringing in broccoli, cauliflower, Brussels sprouts, cabbage, bok choy, lettuce, all those things. Of course, leafy greens you can start picking right away. So that's why they're so popular. You can plant kale and lettuce. You can eat them as you're planting them if you want to. You're growing the leaves. But things where you're harvesting a fruit or something like that, or a whole head like with cabbage, 10 to 12 weeks. But you've got to realize that when we get into the middle of December to about the middle of January, we can either be cold enough that plant growth and metabolism all slows down, or cloudy enough that it does. So there's kind of a lag in there. So things planted in October, you're probably not going to be harvesting in January. You're going to be harvesting those in mid to late February, simply because of that gap in the growing season that we have here from about mid-December to mid-January. But I found this rule pretty much holds. So if you're thinking you want to grow peppers this year, any particular year, you're going to be picking them 10 to 12 weeks out. Yes, you can plant peppers from little plants as late as July 1 and harvest quite a number of peppers in September or even October. And one thing that I do at my garden center, simply because I'm interested in them, and you might find this at others, you can keep planting peppers in containers. This is just one example, all the way into September. Sure, they can buy something in a 2 or 3 gallon pot and it's still flowering, it's still setting fruit, and those fruit will still have a chance to ripen. But basically, whatever you're thinking of growing with your kids or wherever, 10 to 12 weeks from the time you plant it.
So where is the chart that says when things are harvested so that I can count backwards 3 months and know when to plant it?
There are two charts out there. In our region, I have one at redwoodbarn.com. It's a harvest chart. And the Yolo County Master Gardeners have one that we help them work out. It's a laminated thing that you can get from them. They were selling them at their tables when they were doing informational tables at the farmer's market. Those have not resumed. I assume that they will continue to print those out and sell them. Sacramento Master Gardeners have a similar chart, and I believe there's one up in the foothills as well. The whole thing just shifts. You know, where ours begins, as you begin planting things, let's say in March or April, as you get to higher elevations or higher latitudes, that is April to May. So those of you listening to us already know that when we're telling you we're planting tomatoes now because it's the middle of April, you just push that back to your appropriate time in your region. But at our website, redwoodbarn.com, the business website, we have a planting and harvest chart. And your local master gardeners probably have something similar wherever you're listening, because this is such a common theme that comes up. When is it too early? When is it too late? We're at the beginning of the fall and winter season here, a totally different gardening season, something that people who move to California from other climates are simply not accustomed to. They're walking into nurseries and it's 95 degrees and they see broccoli seedlings or cabbage seedlings. And is it really, what's gonna happen to these when we get cold? They like it cold. We're worried about how hot it is, not how cold it's going to get. These are plants that grow through the winter for us here. And we, of course, you know, there'll be plenty of time for us to talk about all of those. They're basically, though, the brassicas, the leafy green, the onion family members, things like that. And, of course, the ever-popular things like turnips, rutabagas, radishes, kohlrabi, beets, the carrots, all the root crops as well.
Okay, so we're not going to go into this one. This is a one-word answer. Do we need to put gypsum on our soil?
No. But the reason it came up is people are driving around right now and seeing these giant piles of white stuff next to the farms. So the farmers are getting...
No.
What?
It's not cocaine.
No. It's not fertilizer. It's gypsum. And so we had a slightly crabby customer who couldn't believe that we weren't selling her gypsum, because, I mean, the farmers are using it. She actually said, so they don't know what they're doing? I said, no, let's back up here. Gypsum is used by row crop farmers. They incorporate it at the time of planting. And there's proven efficacy for this. They incorporate it to the seed beds, incorporate it for the top inch or so to improve seedling emergence. It makes the soil slightly looser, helps the seedlings get out of the soil faster. It enhances water penetration into the top layer of the soil. That's true. So row crop farmers consider the expense, gypsum is cheap. It's not like they're paying a whole lot of money for this. They get a better seedling stand when they incorporate it and direct seed into the field. And a lot of them are about to do that. I don't know, those of you listening elsewhere, what's done in the fields, you know, where there's going to be snow on them. But here, they're crossing their fingers, hoping there's going to be rain. And they're going to be disking or cultivating, tilling the fields, furrowing them, and then drilling in seed of typically winter wheat or something like that, and hoping the rains come along soon enough after they do that to get it to germinate, because sometimes they'll irrigate, sometimes not, depending on what they're growing. And the gypsum apparently helps with more even germination of the seedlings. It's reasonable for that. A farmer won't do something typically if it doesn't improve their yield. They're not going to put $1,000 into something if it doesn't give them $1,000 more worth of yield. It's a very simple spreadsheet calculation for them. If they see a better seedling stand, it reduces their weed management that they have to do or gives them higher yield, they'll do it. And gypsum is pretty economical, and they can do it as part of the whole process of cultivating and seeding. Home gardeners, the things it's touted for are the things that I don't believe are accurate, where they say it loosens clay soil. No, it doesn't. It improves the tilth of the top inch or so for those of you who might be direct seeding, but so does organic material. And doing organic material on a farm would be outlandishly expensive and at high volume, whereas gypsum is simpler for them. So I suggest if you're having trouble getting seedlings to emerge, just top dress your garden with an inch of compost instead of bothering to buy gypsum.
Okay. Don has frequently said that there are a bunch of houseplants that he no longer sells for various reasons. So can you special order those? Which one don't you sell anymore, Don? Can we buy them?
Sure, you can buy them. I can get them for you. I stay away from houseplants that are very susceptible to spider mites. That's one of the first, right there, one of my first most important characteristics as to whether you're going to constantly be battling spider mites, because nothing, there's no pesticide that really works on spider mites. I'm going to just put that out there. Again, if you go online and ask, people are going to jump on and say, use neem oil. Well, I actually saw a study that neem stimulates spider mites and makes them more sexual. So, you know, let's not jump on things that we think are going to work. I just avoid certain cultivars of Diefenbachia. I don't sell any of the indoor palms. Mentioned before, I'm staying away from these ficus. There are really easy houseplants and there's some that are fussy. And the biggest characteristic, in my opinion, that would make me not sell you a houseplant is the propensity to get spider mites. They came up with, someone asked about English ivy as an indoor plant. I don't know if you've ever grown English ivy, Lois, but I guarantee it will get spider mites. And here's the magic part. You take that plant, perfectly cold hardy, so you can put it outside. Put it outside in the shade because it's ivy. It doesn't like hot sun. And the mites will magically go away. And then you bring it back indoors and they come back. And you put it outside and they go away. And you put it indoors and they come back. Because there's plenty of predaceous mites outside and other things. It'll move right in and eat them off the leaf. So you don't see ivy plants out in the landscape covered with spider mites. You see there's a healthy population of mites and predaceous mites and things that eat them and so on all going on out there. Everything's in balance. But inside, the mites just reproduce so much more rapidly and there are so few predatory mites. I suppose you could release predatory mites indoors if you wanted to manage your mites that way. Most people aren't really willing to do beneficial insect releases inside. But it would work, but there are just plants like that are just particularly susceptible to spider mites. I was looking into some of these incredibly colorful aglaonemas, the Chinese evergreen. You go online, you'll see these bright leafed ones, you know, really colorful leaves. Like, I mean, why are these not in the trade? In general, aglaonema or aglaonema is a very tough indoor plant. Chinese evergreen is the common name, but these would sell like crazy. And some of the bigger companies like Costa Farms, who introduce a lot of varieties, actually have them on their website. So I just put that out there to folks in the nursery industry, and every one of them replied, oh, those are spider mite condominiums. I mean, you're just basically inviting them when you do those. Okay, I'm going to stay away from those. Because I want people who are buying houseplants to be successful. I'm very happy for someone who moves beyond the introductory and what you might call, you know, freshman and sophomore level with their houseplants, moves to the upper division level, going ahead and getting into carnivorous plants and gisneriads other than African violets and bromeliads and things like that. That's all cool if you get into that kind of stuff. And if you're willing to do battle with the spider mites on certain plants, buying it and aware of that, fine. But most of my customers who are buying houseplants are kind of beginning gardeners. There is a whole subculture out there that all of us can tell you about of the people who are now zooming around trying to find the latest, greatest variegated monstera and paying $300 for a 4-inch pot. That's a very small part of the market, and those people know what they're doing. But for the most part, I think houseplants should be something that's easy to grow, not stress-inducing. Most of the people buying these are students. They got enough on their plates right now. Get a houseplant that's going to work for you and not something you're going to have to constantly spray. You've been listening to the Davis Garden Show with Don Shore
and Lois Richter here at KDRT-LP 95.7 in Davis, California.
KDRT-FM is a community radio station broadcasting at 95.7 on the FM dial and worldwide at kdrt.org. Community radio relies entirely on contributions from listeners like you and me to support our operating costs. If you want to donate, go to kdrt.org, kdrt.org, and look for the support button. Thanks for your contributions, and thanks for listening to KDRT.